This message comes from NPR sponsor, Discover. Tired of not getting a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
What's good? You're listening to Code Switch from NPR. I'm Gene Debbie. And once again, y'all, we find ourselves in the middle of yet another presidential election cycle. Like, didn't we just do this? And tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the general feeling out there about all of this is somewhere between, I don't know, deep malaise and existential dread. There was a time, though, and it wasn't that long ago, during another presidential election cycle when people were genuinely hopeful. Even though the country was then involved in two ugly, intractable wars, even though people were losing their homes as part of the spiraling financial crisis, like, things were not going great for a lot of people. And yet, that time, I'm talking about the heady days of 2008, is such a stark contrast to this moment. Many of the things that are crises today were still looming back then. They were moving inexorably closer to us, but still a little further out over the horizon. And there was real optimism that maybe, just maybe, some of those things might be interrupted, or at least mitigated. At the center of all that optimism was a genuinely historic candidate who simultaneously confounded and confirmed a lot of the things so many of us thought about how race worked in America. A friend of mine, Vincent Cunningham, had the fortuitous and, I imagine, vertiginous experience of working for that campaign, seeing it all unfold up close and from the inside, which is remarkable because in 2008, Vincent was a college dropout from Harlem, the child he needed to support, and he's trying to make sense of himself and find his footing in the world, like so many of us are trying to do in our 20s. And that whole experience that Vincent went through, that is the basis for his debut novel, Great Expectations, you know, like the Dickens coming-of-age story. And my colleague Brittany Luce sat down with Vincent on a recent episode of her show, It's Been a Minute, to talk to him about his new book. The book is concerned with politics and race, yes, of course, right? But also faith, faith in like the literal sense, but also the kind of civic faith that powered all that hope and change talk back in 2008. And I'm biased here because Vincent and Brittany are two of the people I most enjoy listening to think out loud, but we figured we should run their conversation on Code Switch. So I'm gonna just stop with the preamble and let them have it. Here you go.
In my opinion, Vincent has written a great American novel, and I don't say that lightly. It has so much to say about the optimism of that time, American politics as a sort of religion, and what it means to search for something to believe in. I sat down with Vincent to get into all that and why faith in politics feels so far away in today's world. Vincent, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Brittany, how you doing? Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
I am so thrilled to be able to talk to you about this book.
Oh, man. Thank you so much.
The time period that the story is set in, 2007, 2008, it's this very specific period in American history. But I was also in my early 20s back then.
Yeah.
And so much of what you described felt so familiar. Just even the energy of that time. What were things about that time that you remember feeling that you really wanted to get across to the reader?
Sure, sure. The book begins with David Hammond watching the senator give the speech that would inaugurate his candidacy.
Right.
And this candidate, just as Obama did, chooses to make that speech where Abraham Lincoln gave the same kind of speech.
In the shadow of the old state capitol, where Lincoln once called on a house divided to stand together, I stand before you today to announce my candidacy for president of the United States of America.
To say, you know, here I am, a black man, standing in the same place that the president who freed the slaves stood. Electing me would be an event of similar symbolic significance. Hope and change was the cliche that came over and over from the campaign. But
oh, yes.
This idea of America almost as a literary text, with passages that felt inevitable, that certain strands that started in the 19th century could culminate now, right? That you could have a narrative complete itself through the figure of one person, right?
Mm. The resolution of a narrative. Say more about what you mean by that.
he would talk about Lincoln in this way that made you think about emancipation and think about how it might culminate in a black mm-hmm. president. He would talk a lot about King and how perhaps the dream of Dr. King, as they talked about it when we were kids, you know, the dream of Dr. King could be resolved in him.
I chose to run in this election at this moment because of what Dr. King called the fierce urgency of now.
You know, he was very deft at creating these correspondences between the present moment and the past of the country. One of the jobs of a novel is to manage symbols in this way too, right? You're trying to create correspondences, things that like ring like bells all across the text. And so it was interesting to try to do that around a figure who had done that in real life.
Something that I recall from that time is like a sort of wild optimism mm-hmm. that so many people held. How is that manic optimism unique to that period?
Well, you know, I've tried to think about this a lot. There was so much reason not to hope in the very beginning of this century with the Iraq War abroad, and certainly for me at least, Katrina at home, that said the world is not right. Yeah. And so to have a figure who, you know, had stood against the Iraq War, was sort of a moral voice vis-a-vis Katrina, I think it was still possible to believe at this moment, at least for people of my age, that somebody could resolve things, could on some level atone for things. I think I wrote this partially to look back and find the sources of those hopes. Mm. Maybe it was just because I was young, you know, maybe it was just because I was in my 20s. But it wasn't just me.
No, it wasn't just you.
There were people older than us who felt that too. And I think maybe it's something about carrying around the weight of a country that has done so much that needs to be accounted for. When somebody comes along that makes you think, you know, you might finally feel better about those things, I think that's a seductive thing to accept and go with.
It's interesting because I remember feeling a lot of optimism, but also that even that optimism in and of itself, it took me a journey to get there. Similarly to David in the first chapter of Great Expectations, when he sees the candidate announce his candidacy on the steps of the Illinois State House, David comes away thinking, I can't say that I thought he would win. And I'll be honest, I didn't think that in my real life about Barack Obama for quite a while.
Yeah.
I'll say, I just never thought a black man was going to be president in my own lifetime. It felt like to me as a young person, like, oh, something happened before my eyes that I never imagined would happen in my lifetime. So what else is possible?
What else is possible?
And it's addictive, I think, to kind of feel that to a certain extent.
Yeah. But to see it happen was like a true mental transformation. I totally agree.
Yeah, it makes me think about one of the things that's really central to Great Expectations. David's desire to believe in something.
Yeah.
You know, he grew up in a strongly religious household, but, you know, he wavered in and out of belief starting in college. And during the story, he redirects some of his desire to believe into his job in politics. Like, while I think all humans, or at least most, the overwhelming majority, search for something to believe in, Great Expectations also looks at near religious belief as a central force of American politics. How is belief baked into the American political landscape?
I think, as someone who was raised just like David Hammond, I was raised in a religious environment. Mm-hmm. I was taught to read scripturally. The way that you address a bit of scriptural literature is you're using all of your powers of metaphor, foreshadowing, reading something in the Old Testament, looking how it might ring forward and culminate in Christ or something like that. I think that that is deeply embedded in American political thinking. Because I think of the way, especially since we're such a textual nation, it's like how the Declaration and the Constitution then come along and ring again in, let's say, the Gettysburg Address, how Lincoln almost rewrites the Declaration of Independence, how then King's speeches reach back to those former sources. This has been a nation of a kind of scriptural interpretation of our founding documents. Hmm. This kind of reading, I think, is, to me at least, important to how America sees itself moving forward.
Coming up, the role of fathers in Great Expectations and in our political fantasies. Stick around.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. The 1 Million Black Businesses Initiative is an award-winning program created by Shopify and Operation Hope, a commitment to start, grow, and scale 1 million Black businesses by 2030. Develop your business with award-winning courses, virtual workshops, and one-on-one coaching. Chart your own path for business success with the 1 Million Black Businesses Initiative and Shopify. Find an exclusive 120-day free trial at shopify.com/codeswitch.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. What's the right amount of socializing for you? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can help you figure out your boundaries, how to recharge, and your social sweet spot, so you can build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Try therapy with BetterHelp. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month. This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we have very important people on our show and then ask them about very unimportant things. Here's U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
We are also reliably informed that among your enthusiasms, in addition to macroeconomic policy, is mobile games.
There's some truth in that.
There's some truth in that.
Join us for the NPR podcast that considers all the other things. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce, chatting with New Yorker critic Vincent Cunningham about his new book titled Great Expectations and the fantasy of paternalism in politics. Fathers are all over this book. I've been very interested in the fatherness of it all. David's complicated relationships to the father that is God, mm-hmm. the fathers of the nation, the senator as a father figure, his own father, himself as a father. In so many ways, this book feels like an examination of the patriarch, like the simultaneous love and hatred for the patriarch. I wonder how you see all of that as being related to politics.
Yeah, our various ways of looking up and how those things are gendered. First of all, super dangerous. It leads to statements like, you know, what we really need is a strong leader, which is like the beginning of all political evil, right? And it's partially to, I guess Donald Trump said it this way, only I can fix it. Obama, through different symbolic or implicit means, said something similarly about like my inherent identity can help move us into a new passage in American life or whatever. Both, I think, being like very, not male essentially, but male rhetorically ways of saying, basically, kick back and let me take the wheel. Really anti-political statements, really, that say, you don't have to worry anymore. A certain kind of male charisma says, pats you on the head and says, I'll take it from here. Thank you so much.
It's like a desire for paternalism.
Yeah. Did you ever, when you were a kid, watch the cartoon? It was called Wait Till Your Father Gets Home.
That sounds so familiar.
Wait till your father gets until your father gets home.
Wait till your father gets home.
But it was like this, some like harried white housewife being like, your dad's going to get home and apply the belt to you or whatever. And I feel like, you know, America's it's sometimes that cartoon. Like that's what the election cycles are like. It's like, dad's finally going to get home. He's going to set this all right.
I mean, I see so much of that messaging, I feel like.
Yeah. And it is like sort of to kind of double back to this religious framing. It's also very messianic in quality. It's like, no, the one is out there. This isn't some of the frustration with Biden right now. By you clinging on, we're forestalling or delaying the arrival of the one.
I want to read a line from David to you.
Oh, thank you.
Perhaps you know it.
I might, even though I feel like I blacked out several times while writing this book. But let's try.
All right. David says at one point in this book, I was made to feel most at home amid excruciating cognitive dissonance, the kind that never resolved. I believed and didn't believe, and felt the strain. That really resonated with my team and with me. And it feels like one of the most apt descriptions of what it is like to live today, to like see what's happening in Gaza or living through the continuation of the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, believing that a better world is possible, but like faltering in that belief constantly, like that excruciating cognitive dissonance is every day.
That's right. It's a political reality. You know, you can watch the excruciating images coming out of Gaza and then go to some cocktail party. It goes on and on. I mean, that quote comes from a part of the book where he's talking specifically about his upbringing and how someone could say something awful about a gay person over the pulpit, but then every person in the choir that's going to sing right after this horrible sermon, several of those people are obviously gay. That we can say we believe this, but then this other thing is right there under the crust. And you're supposed to keep a double mind or a sort of compartmentalized mind about rhetorical reality and actual reality, or political reality and personal reality. The more ludicrous and more sort of surreal those distances become, I think the more that mental strain also becomes. You end up not being able to articulate things that you know about life. They haven't been spoken before.
I've had that experience where something is happening and you know that it's real, but it runs so counter to something that you've been told to believe or something that you've been taught that you can't even find the language express the truth of a given situation, because it's just like, it might as well be on two separate planets.
That's right. Maybe one way to sort of define growing up is to finally develop a private language that can accommodate more reality. That can accommodate more of what you actually feel as opposed to what you hear from without.
I love that. Private language. I love that. You know, I can't help but think about where belief fits into politics today. For many Americans, it feels like the kind of faith that you talk about in this book, corresponding with the Obama era. That kind of faith feels so far away, I feel like, right now for many people. Why do you think that is?
The sort of tragicomic reality of that moment of hope is that right at the moment that Obama is elected is also basically right when the financial crisis starts, right? Toward the end of the book and toward the end of the campaign, this happens. The hope immediately sort of reached a crest and started to cascade. Having lost so many faith in so many institutions, the rise of mass movements, whether it be Occupy Wall Street or Black Lives Matter, or in the last 2 or 3 years, a really, for me, heartening revival of the labor movement. Maybe it means that, okay, we've displaced that faith and placed it in each other.
I mean, and that's also like a very obvious foil for that father figure, like for that paternalism. Like, you can't desire one leader if you are focused on spreading and multiplying your faith among the people around you.
That's right. Yeah. It's such a paradox that, like, even though Obama in our minds still has this, if, like you mentioned, if you go back to that time, the word that comes up in connection with him is hope. It might just be that his emergence, like the perfectly charismatic presidential candidate, the person who symbolized so much that mattered to us, maybe he was the end of the charismatic presidency. Maybe the disillusionment that followed that experience has finally taught us that no election is actually going to be the epical moment. All through my life, every election has been the most important one ever. And like, yes. My body does not respond to that signal anymore.
Well, Vincent.
Brittany.
I have really enjoyed talking about this book.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Vincent Cunningham. His book, Great Expectations, is out this week, and you can find his other work at The New Yorker.
That was Vincent Cunningham in conversation with Brittany Luce of It's Been a Minute, and that's our show. You can follow us on Instagram at NPR Code Switch. If email's more your bag, ours is codeswitch@npr.org. You should subscribe to the podcast on the NPR app or wherever it is you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to the Code Switch newsletter by going to npr.org/codeswitchnewsletter. And another way to support us at Code Switch is to sign up for Code Switch Plus. It's small, but really makes a difference for us. And you'll get to listen to every episode we've ever done on Code Switch without any ads. So check it out at plus.npr.org/codeswitch. And thanks to everybody who's already signed up. This segment of It's Been a Minute was produced by Liam McBain and edited by Jessica Plachek, with additional production support from Barton Girdwood, Alexis Williams, and Corey Antonio Rose. And for Code Switch, this episode was produced by Jess Kung and edited by Dahlia Mortada. And we'd be remiss, of course, if we did not shout out the rest of the Code Switch massive. That's Christina Kala, Xavier Lopez, Leah Danella, Vera Lynn Williams, B.A. Parker, Cher Vincent, and Lori Lizaraga. As for me, I'm Gene Demby. Be easy, y'all.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor, Lisa, in collaboration with West Elm. Discover the new Natural Hybrid mattress, expertly crafted from natural latex and certified safe foams, designed with your health and the planet in mind. Visit leesa.com to learn more.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
On It's Been a Minute, we're keeping you in the know when it comes to culture. I break down the latest trends and the forces behind them and introduce you to the creatives who think deeply about how we live today. Come for some good old cultural analysis and have a few laughs with me. Listen to the It's Been a Minute podcast from NPR.